Welcome to the Fourth Watch Podcast, a curated conversation with some of the most interesting voices in the media. I'm Steve Krakauer. Today, we're doing something a little different. I am very glad to be joined by Brian Stelter, longtime media reporter, former CNN host. He's joining me today to talk about my new book, Uncovered. This is episode 39. So today's episode will be a little different. Uncovered, how the media got cozy with power, abandoned its principles, and lost the people, is my book that is out this week, available wherever you get your books. You can find it at readuncovered.com. And I asked Brian Stelter, who I have known for 15 years. We go way back. I've gone through some twists and turns in our careers. I think that we agree on certain things and we disagree quite strongly on other things. But I asked him to come join me in this setting for a long forum conversation, sort of interviews me about Uncovered. And so what you're going to hear is that conversation unedited, uncensored, all about Uncovered and the state of the media today. So enjoy. Brian Stelter, thank you for joining me here on this very special edition of the Fourth Watch Podcast. I want to give a little bio on Brian and a little bit on how we know each other. We go way back. The media careers have kind of been ships passing in the night in some ways. Brian started TV Newser way back when he was in college, which was incredible. If anyone who remembers the early days of TV Newser, just such a rare blog at the time, and just was crushing it. When Brian left to go to the New York Times, Chris Ahrens took over. He hired me as the associate editor. Brian and I met for the first time back in November of 2007. So we've known each other for about 15 years, met in the New York Times cafeteria. And then Brian was the media reporter for the New York Times for a while, wrote several bestsellers, and is the producer of The Morning Show on Apple. He also, of course, most notably, was at CNN. We missed each other at CNN by a few weeks. I left in August 2013. Brian started shortly after that, was the host of the Reliable Sources program, which sadly no longer exists, was the editor of the Reliable Sources newsletter, very well read, sadly no longer exists. Okay, it does exist, I'm told.
In a different form. It's excellent. It's with Oliver Darcy now.
Oliver there. And obviously was the chief media correspondent for a long time until about, as he's tweeted about recently, about 6 months ago, was no longer at CNN. And now we are joined here to talk about Uncovered, my book that was out this week. And Brian, I sent one of the earliest copies that I could send. I think it was October, November of last year. and really, this is a sort of a, that's my intro. And now I'm going to try to hand it over to Brian. This will be kind of a discussion or an interview, however we want to go. And we'll see where it goes. So really, I appreciate you doing this. I've wanted to talk to you for a while. I mean, we talk offline, but I've wanted to talk on the record also, and I wanted to have an interview with someone that I think may have some agreement with the book, but also may have some disagreement, and I think that's important.
And now I get to take over. This is going to be cool. Have you ever been interviewed on your own podcast before?
Certainly not. No. This is a new experience. I'm enjoying it.
Okay. Oh well, you're enjoying it, but we haven't really started yet. So let's see if you enjoy it in a few minutes, right?
That's right.
Okay, so I'm in charge, although I know you're going to try to turn the tables.
Yes, it'll just be a discussion.
I'll tell you what I love about your book. What I love about your book is that you're coming at the media and writing about the media from a place of being constructive and not destructive. Because, you know, if anybody knows anything about me, you know, it was all about Donald Trump and his war against the media and how's the media fighting back. And in my view, what Trump was doing was he was trying to be destructive. But you, with what you write about in the book, you're trying to be constructive. You're coming at this from a place of let's make the press better because we all benefit when the press is healthier and stronger and more representative of our country and our citizens. So let's start from that place with what went wrong? Like what broke? What's the 60-second version of what broke in this country?
Yeah, it's something I've thought a lot about, and obviously it's really the basis of the book. Because look, I was at CNN from 2010 to 2013. I think there were some valid criticisms of places like CNN and other outlets, New York Times, you know, ABC, CBS, pick your news network, your sort of corporate media news network. But it also felt extremely different than the way things shifted in 2016 and 2017, which is really where the book starts. It really starts in 2014, but obviously 2015, 2016 became a big inflection point. And I've tried to figure out what it was that changed. And I've laid out five big problems with the media, from a geographic bias to coziness with power. One that I think is a huge factor more recently in the rise of social media, the way social media can make journalists into influencers, and this sort of anti-speech activism that I call it, which is really, I think, started more 2020 and beyond. And so I do think that there are some new phenomenons in the modern media that have made this problem worse. And I as you mentioned, I love the media. I love my time at CNN. I think we need a strong media. We need a media that's trusted. We see poll after poll of the press, the decline in trust in the press. I don't like that. I don't want to see it destroyed. We need independent media. We need strong institutional media. And so I do try to set out to identify problems and see if I can find some solutions.
But there's always been, for example, a geographic bias, meaning, you know, the networks and the major papers have always been on the East Coast in New York and D.C. And there's always been, frankly, too much coziness with power. I mean, at least for as long as television and radio have existed. So why, what do you think is different about the mid-2000, what do we call them, teens? Yeah. You know, what was it that stood out to you, you know, in the last 5, 6, 7 years?
Yeah, so I do think that geographic bias took a couple different forms. On one level, what was already existing between, you know, the way, let's just take CNN as an example, right? Yes, CNN had a strong New York bureau and a strong DC bureau. But in 2012, when I was covering every election night, I was going to Atlanta. And Atlanta, it's you know, it's not like I was spending my time in the streets of Georgia. I was mostly in the CNN center, but at least you're hiring a lot of people that are not from these, what I call the Acela media, the Acela corridor, New York and DC, or you're not flying people that are from all over the country and planting them in a very specific bubble. And so I do think that we've seen a little bit more of a shift away from that. Atlanta basically no longer is really a part of CNN now. And I think we've seen a little consolidation.
On. There's lots of producers in Atlanta. I agree with you that New York has become more of a hub though for CNN, definitely.
And especially NBC. On TV. Yes. And I do think that the other big factor, this in terms of the geographic bias, for example, is COVID related, you know, by design. Wow. So in 2020, you know, the idea of getting out there, it became much harder to do physically. And I do think that there was a real, you know, push to, I mean, people were literally in their houses, especially the people that were working in New York and DC. Now there's a pendulum swing the other direction also, which I think might be helpful, is that we saw with the pandemic that work from home is right. A lot more possible in the media. So I do hope that maybe in the future, as we're coming out of this, we're seeing people that can be in their own locations, in their own communities, and get the job done. I actually think that's a positive, but I do think that was a shift that we saw even in 2020 and beyond.
Wasn't so much of the focus, though, so much of the DC focus in the Trump years, a reflection of the unprecedented and dramatic and for many Americans scary and for other Americans exhilarating moment that we were in as a country? I mean, because you know, this gets to this idea that, you know, there's too much attention around Trump, too much coverage, too much criticism. But I look back and I think that was history. Like, we lived yeah. through history, and it was unlike anything any living American had ever seen before. So of course it deserved 24/7 attention.
Huh? It's one of the reasons why I am not critical in the book. I specifically make this point of the early coverage by CNN, by MSNBC, by other places. But CNN really got some grief from the left for the way they covered Trump in the primary, for example. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, the empty podium and playing the speeches with and not doing the same for other candidates. I disagree with that. I mean, he was a phenomenon, like you talk about. He was the news. And, you know, Jeff Zucker, who I worked with in 2013, there was this real one story mentality. You know, when I was there, it was the Boston bombing. We put all our resources to that. And he got criticism for things like the poop cruise or things like the missing plane. But again, I defend all of that. I think what's interesting, I think the missing plane is an amazing story. I know that there's a new Netflix special.
Of course it is. It's actually a bigger story today. Every day the plane is missing, it's a bigger story. But
okay. It is. No, I love that story. And so yes, I think the Trump phenomenon was very worth covering. And I also think, and I'm not super critical of the press for being tough on the Trump administration, just in theory, Because I think that journalists should be tough on every administration. And so, yeah, I think it's a little bit hypocritical when it's much tougher on one administration than, say, the one before it or the one after it. But I don't fault them. I want tough press on administrations across the board. The problem, though, is when it goes overboard and when I think the guardrails, the journalistic guardrails, start being eased off. And I wonder if you agree with this, but my thinking is that what happened is that there was some business decision making going on. He was great for business. And so you know, it's great, you know, getting more clicks and getting more views, great for business. There's something personal about it. You know, he had personal relationships with a lot of journalists. I mean, I mentioned in the book people like Jeff Zucker, but also Gail King and Katie Couric and Matt Lauer. They were at his wedding in 2005. He was in that media scene, then he became this turncoat. So it was business and personal. But I also think that there were a lot of people at newsrooms across the DC and New York that believed that there was this real existential threat, that Trump was an existential threat, and there was a sense of we have to save democracy here. And so because of that, there was, yes, we have these standards, but they have to be loosened because this is a unique opportunity. This is a unique moment. We must meet that unique moment by doing this. Now, I would argue that.
So was he not a threat to democracy?
So I don't think he was an existential threat to democracy. And we could debate whether he was or not, but I personally don't think he was. But I would say that let's just say that he was, that I would say the much better way of going about it is to double down on the editorial standards. That's when, if you really want to convince the public and convince the largest swath of the public that this is really an existential threat that we're in, then that's when you actually have to really adhere to the principles even more so everyone can trust you. And instead, I think they went the opposite direction and actually sort of hurt the case when a lot of, now all of a sudden, everything gets called, oh, they're just making it up. Well, when right, actually there right. were legitimate stories.
I think I put more responsibility on the press bashers and you put more on the press. And that's fair, you know, and that's the tug of war. In my mind, when any world leader tries to destroy a news outlet, that's a crisis. Not a crisis, that's a threat. That's a big threat. And I think what you say is you're putting more responsibility on the news outlets, whereas I find more concern in the rhetoric and the behavior of the leader.
Well, I think the rhetoric for sure, the tweets, the comments that he said, the, you know, enemy of the people, I didn't like any of that. But I do think that so much of Trump was the rhetoric and not the actions. And I compare it to the Obama administration in chapter one on the way that Obama and his Department of Justice really, really clamped down on press freedom through the use of the Espionage Act to sort of criminalize journalism and journalistic sources. And that more, they use the Espionage Act more than any other administration combined, including the Trump administration. James Risen, who was one of those people under the Obama administration who really was you know, attacked in that way, of the New York Times, wrote that if President Trump targets the press, blame Obama. And I think so much of that, it seeded the ground here because Obama, it was not friendly with the press, and yet he was treated much more favorably. And then you get Trump, and yes, rhetoric-wise, much worse. I mean, just over-the-top rhetoric about everything. But action-wise, yes, he pulled some press passes. I spoke out even in favor of Jim Acosta not losing his press pass. That was over the line. But mostly rhetoric and not action, I would say.
Huh. See, I could spend the rest of the hour just listing all of the actions he took against the press, right? Trying to get Rupert Murdoch to take over CNN, trying to sue stop the deal, trying to tell people what to watch and what not to watch, right? Trying to destroy Fox News after the 2020 election because Fox briefly reported the truth about Biden winning. I mean, I think there are so many actions, but look, I think you and I disagree fundamentally about that post-election period, right? January 6th, how meaningful it was. You've been quite critical of how the press has covered January 6th and the aftermath. Yes. I'm curious what you think of Tucker Carlson getting a hold of the surveillance tapes.
I think it's great. I wish everyone got a hold of them. I mean, I.
But that's not what they're doing.
True. I don't necessarily. I think that this is how a lot of this works. I think if it was, there's a reason that CNN had lots of exclusives of certain January 6th footage and other news outlets had exclusives about January 6th activity from the January 6th committee that they were getting fed. And so this is how it works. It's not ideal, but I favor more transparency across the board. I think that there are still absolutely questions about January 6th that are not being addressed. I wish that they were in the January 6th committee. But yeah, I definitely think, and there's a few topics that I wish I wrote more about in the book. January 6th is definitely one of them. I think it was January 6th. I always give the caveat: very bad, very very bad day, bad riot. The way that it was then turned into something that could be made not just about Trump, but about, in my opinion, about half the country, and to the overreach that came from it, I think has been really detrimental to the press. I never really understood it, other than the fact that Trump was gone, and so it became like the stand-in for Trump. I do wonder about that, and I hope.
It's never happened before in our lives, and hopefully it'll never happen again. It was a violent riot at our seat of power, and it should never happen. That's why it was taken seriously.
It should be taken seriously. And you know, hundreds of people have been prosecuted, and I support all of that. And I think that the curiosity, I think that, or the lack of curiosity by the press is that they're so focused on certain aspects of it and not others. I think that there were big security concerns. I'm glad that some in the press covered the fact that ultimately the final January 6th report was to the complaints, as we've read in places like NBC, which has done some good reporting on it, the complaints internally that so much of that final report was focused only on Trump and not on the massive security failures.
Right, and not on security. Right, that was a glaring absence in the report. You're right. I think what this gets to is we simply live in two or three, I think three different media universes in America. Solutions proposed in one universe aren't going to apply to the other, and people speaking in one universe aren't going to be heard in the other except through distorted out of context clips. How can we be constructive and try to improve trust in media when there are so many people, so many companies, so many hosts, so many businesses that are built on keeping people in their echo chambers?
Yeah, it's a huge problem, and I don't disagree that it's across the board. It's not one side or the other. I think one of the biggest problems in the press is that there's not really a financial incentive to, when you get a story wrong, correct it. There's not really a mechanism for it. It's very hard to find the people that you originally heard the story that turned out not to be true to now be told that actually what you were told and sort of was ingrained in your mind. And so I think that's unfortunate. In the last chapter of the book, I give some potential solutions. One of them, which I'm a huge supporter of, is ombudsman, public editors. I think they should be at every major media outlet. They used to be at places like the New York Times. They're gone now. There are people that are within organizations like a David Folkenflik at NPR, who I think serves that role. He'll occasionally write about NPR. I think that that's important. So I think that there needs to be an effort we should have a press that is interested in telling the entire story, in reaching a broad amount of audience. And that's actually one of the other big problems, is that as audiences, just audience habits shift, There's less and less people. The pie is getting smaller and smaller, even for large media or outlets. I write about ESPN and the way that ESPN has shifted. And I think part of that is the fact that there's just this acknowledgement that we're no longer going to be for everyone. We don't need to be for everyone. Now we only are going to be for every single day. It's for less and less people that they're going to potentially reach from a traditional means. And I think that's unfortunate. That's why I think that we need strong independent press, but we need strong institutional press also, because it's not going to be easily solved. But I think that the first thing is acknowledging it, having some introspection, and also starting to correct the record on some of the stories that organizations got wrong.
What are the ones that stand out most to you? What did me and my colleagues at CNN screw up the most in your view?
Well, I start the book with the Hunter Biden laptop story. And I think that it's an important one for a few reasons. I think we've seen with the Twitter files, which notably has not gotten very much coverage at all in the corporate press. I think there's actually a few reasons for it. I think the rollout of it was not exactly successful. But I think that there, one of those, the elements here is that there was a real suppression of that story, not just by tech platforms in conversation with with government entities like intel agencies like the FBI, but also from media organizations. Now, the question is, why was that? And maybe, you know, if they doubted the story was real, and I think that they did doubt the story was real. I don't necessarily dispute that. And they were spun by these people like James Clapper, who now, even just last week, is still refusing to accept accountability for the fact that he put that letter out along with many other people. And that was then spread by places like Politico, by CNN and others. And it left this impression where years later now, yes, now we're starting to get some reporting that actually the laptop's real and it was all legitimate. But certainly in October of 2020, before a very important election, we're not going to go down that road, especially not by the scars of 2016 and the criticisms of how they treated Hillary's emails and not wanting to make that same mistake again. So you had journalists that were literally getting their accounts locked on Twitter and deleting the tweet that was linking to the New York Post when that was apparently no longer allowed. We had Maggie Haberman at the New York Times, a great reporter who dared to like send a link to the New York Post where she used to work, and she's getting called MAGA Haberman for this. It was just a really, and getting called that not by activists, but by other journalists and other journalists like at NBC telling people, do not link to the New York Post, do not even reference it. That's a real chilling thing, because it's one thing to try to tiptoe into the story, and it's another to treat it as if it's this toxic material that completely spins the public in a really wrong direction.
See, I think that's Twitter's problem, right? Separate from the press. If Twitter screwed up, we should go after Twitter, right? But didn't newsroom, I think newsroom just looked around and said, we don't have the laptop. We don't have evidence. We don't have evidence it's real. And we know that there are reasons to wonder if it's disinformation. Like, a lot of the lies that happen now about what happened in 2020 go like this. They say, all these assholes, they all called it disinformation. That's not true. A lot of us just wondered. We said out loud, could this be?
Right.
We said things like, some former U.S. officials think it might be. And it was always cushioned and called, it was not always. It was often cushioned that way. And now in retrospect, 2 years later, 3 years later, partisans like to pretend that it was labeled disinformation, which it wasn't.
There was
concern. There was reason to be concerned, not because of Hillary emails, but because of the Russian attempt in 2016, which I know you probably think was overstated.
Well, I definitely think it was overstated, but I also think that, yes, okay, so yes, there was some, and I will say, you know, the reporting around it by saying things like it has all the hallmark, all the earmarks of Russian disinformation, which is what the intel agency said, that is essentially telling people this is probably that. And there wasn't a lot of saying, well, here's what's being reported. We don't know if this is true, but I would dispute the fact that, look, I think during the Trump years, there was a big effort. We talked about Russia in 2016 and then the Mueller report. One outlet like the New York Times or the Washington Post would have an exclusive, sometimes single, sometimes maybe double sourced on some little element of what's going on with Mueller. And no one's seen the Mueller report, but they had one story and then that gets spun. That's an entire news cycle. And so with this, though, because it's the New York Post, because it's Rudy Giuliani and admittedly, it's the semi-blind repair shop, shop guy. Okay, yeah, it's a little bit hazier maybe than just having the New York Post or the New York Times.
A New York Post reporter that like didn't want to have their byline on the story. There's a lot of problems with it, but I know you know that.
There's red flags with it, 100%. But we saw that in the intervening 4 years that these sort of single stories where you don't need to see the source material, but this is being reported by this outlet and that becomes a story. Sometimes that turned out to be true and sometimes it definitely did not. With this, we didn't see that. And I think that coupled with the lack of outrage by the press over the New York Post censorship by Twitter, the way they were locked out of their Twitter account for weeks, the way that the link to that article was censored, that was most concerning to me.
Do you think it's an example of coziness to power? I mean, that's one of the subtitles of Uncovered, right? That the press got too cozy to power.
I think
because at that point, Donald Trump is the most powerful because he's president. But I know oftentimes in the view of some of your, do I call them fans? Like, I've seen you on Fox and Friends and Tucker Carlson this week. Like in their view, Trump was never really in power. It's really the deep state or the elites.
Well,
so is that coziness to power?
I think that, Olivia Nuzzi, who we know at New York Magazine, has a quote in the book, and I will say all the people in the book are on the record and put their name to it, where she says that, that there was no social penalty when you went after Trump or the Trump administration. In fact, it was just the opposite. There was a social incentive to do so. Whereas with the Biden administration, if you go hard at that, they're actually, it's the almost the opposite. She didn't use the term coziness with power, but there are people that are cozy, not necessarily like best friends, but that they know each other. They're part of the same system and have been for a long time. The kids go to the same schools, that sort of thing. So I do think that there was, even though obviously, yes, Trump was the president, he was very powerful. Mm-hmm. He was not part of that same establishment that had been there forever. I mean,
Well, look, the way I describe it is like, when was Jen Psaki named press secretary, right? She was named at the beginning of the Biden. And it was like, oh, great. I already have her cell phone number. Great. But I felt the same way when Sean Spicer was named White House press secretary. I mean, listen, I trusted Spicer. I thought Spicer and Priebus were going to make sure that, that 2017 didn't get out of control. And then it got out of control in my view. But
well, they got pushed out,
Well, but even when they were there, but my point is like, that is true, right? If you could call that coziness, or you could just call that reporters who are well-sourced, who know the right people. I don't know, you know, you could go different ways on that.
100%. And that's also why I think it's complicated. You know, I don't think that just because you know a person, you are just like completely, you know, unable to cover them for one point. I mean, you know, if you're really, you know, it, like Tucker Carlson.
But then it gets really murky because you should at least be very careful about how you address it. You should disclose, I mean, err on the side of disclosure. I think we need to see much more disclosure of those sorts of relationships in journalism. But the social penalty thing is really interesting, right? Because in the right-wing media universe, to go after Biden, there is no social penalty. Obviously, there's the opposite. Right. To go after Trump, there is still to some degree a social penalty. So you focus so much on the ABCs and CNNs, don't you let the Foxes and Newsmaxes off the hook?
I spend the second to last chapter, I base it around the idea of like, what if I'm wrong, right? And I base it around a conversation that I had with a former media executive, which I don't name, but they basically, I called them to see if they would be a source for the book. They declined and they said, basically, your whole premise is wrong. You know, this book, the most important story is Fox News and the way that they have a grip on the Republican Party. They're afraid of Donald Trump. And I said,
I think I know who it was.
Okay. Well, you can tell me after. I don't want to reveal who it is. This person read the book, had some nice things to say and had some very clear criticisms also. But I told this person, Brian already wrote that book. You know, but not just that, like, so much of media criticism is aimed in one direction. And I will say, I will accept that there are absolutely criticisms of Fox News and the way that they cover Trump, in the way that they continue to cover certain aspects of just the universe. I don't think that they are exempt from it. And occasionally in Fourth Watch, my newsletter, I will take that on. But I do try to go from a different perspective because I don't think it's really happening much at all from people that again, as you say, like the media and I want it to be better and are not trying to destroy it. And then the second reason is I do think that there's a cultural cachet that places like CNN in particular, which is, it is curious. I was talking to Will Cain about this. Why is it that CNN is so important, much more so than ABC or CBS or NBC News or certainly MSNBC? Real cultural cachet to places like the New York Times, places like CNN. And so, it does, despite the fact that Fox has many more viewers, it's much more important the way that those news organizations operate. That's why I spent so much time on the Tom Cotton op-ed fallout in the book, because I just think we need to have places like the New York Times. It's hard to describe why that is, but we need them to be trusted. We need them to be places of a exchange of ideas, they need to be the ones that are at the paramount of free speech. And so that's also why I think they're much more important in some ways than what Fox News is doing that may not be journalistically sound.
I think the importance comes partly from the journalism muscle, the newsroom muscle, meaning the New York Times has far more reporters than USA Today. And CNN has far more journalists than Fox News. And, CNN then wins on big news days. They're usually on the scene first, all that sort of stuff. There's so much less news muscle that exists in right-wing media, which frustrates me because I wish there were more journalists in right-wing media and fewer talking heads. But at the same time, that's why you want to focus more on newsrooms. And I get that, right? That it's more important to focus on who's gathering the raw materials that everybody else on the left and right then talks about and fights over. The raw materials are really important, and the raw materials need to be trusted.
And it gets at this idea of objectivity in general and fairness. Mm. Like, is that something to strive for? That's a real debate that's happening right now. And
is somebody arguing we shouldn't be fair? What do you mean?
Well, I think people are saying that we should be fair, but I think the word objectivity has become a real point of contention. In the book, Amy Chozick, right, who was at the New York Times and she covered Hillary Clinton, she describes that there's a debate going on that's essentially, is objectivity akin to white supremacy? And that's an actual debate that's happening in newsrooms like at the New York Times and other places. And that's a really important aspect here, right? I think that the question of should journalists strive to be fair to both sides, to that, you know, or to all sides, to give viewers the facts and let them find their way to where their conclusions are. I think that's actually something that's being debated now. And that's something that I think is I don't know if you agree, but I think that that's something that is even more reason to shine a light on places that in theory should be objective.
I think we need to show that we've walked all the way around the block before we've started to write about the block. And, you know, that's my way of saying, let's be fair to everybody. Let's make sure that we're being fair. Let's make sure we've seen the full story. Because if you're only writing about the story from the backyard, then you're probably missing a big part of the story. That said, when a congressman like George Santos is elected and then it's revealed that he lied about his entire life, which shows incredible disrespect and disregard and contempt for the voters who now regret voting for him. In that situation, we shouldn't be holding back or acting like, maybe there's another, maybe he was telling the truth. Like when journalists have a fact that they can look at a piece of paper and know, that is when I think they should assert their experience and expertise and say, this is a fact.
And George Santos, he actually has been getting it from incoming from, I would say, Fox too, which is interesting.
I agree. I just love the Santos example because it's this example of the system actually working.
Yes.
Because yes, he was elected and in my view, he shouldn't have been. But then journalists uncovered these stories, the New York Times, and then many other journalists found more examples. And then local reporters went to visit his family and friends. And then reporters in D.C. chased him down the hall. To me, the system's working in that case. And it's making sure that there's a penalty. You use social penalty. There's a social penalty for lying.
Yes. No, I agree with that. And I want to go back to one thing that you said there. But let me ask you first, do you think that, let me ask you this now. So I do think that there's an important point that, like, there. Sometimes I'm critical of the press and it's because they're essentially late. I wish that we knew George Santos' story earlier. I guess he's sort of a under the radar, you know, candidate. But like I look at like the John Fetterman story as something where we learned so much in a New York Times story only a few weeks ago about the true condition of John Fetterman. Mm. And so, yes, I think that was late. And in the book, I describe it as a sort of hypocritical corrective. But we can thank the New York Times for being the ones that have revealed this information to us. So sure, I wish they would have done that story a lot earlier. I don't know why it is that they wait, but it does seem like, okay, he's a senator now, and now we can tell you what the real story is. And that's something also I think people
notice. That's so cynical. I think that's so cynical to the point of conspiratorial, that journalists are sitting on information until he's elected. Come on.
So maybe it's just the fact that, okay, now he's elected. Now we've developed our sources to the point that we have more and we can actually go with it. Or, you know, I don't know, but that's a good example of it. Someone who's been on the Fetterman beat and then drops this. And yet when Dasha Burns of NBC dares to say that, you know, he doesn't seem to be able to communicate when he doesn't have the thing in front of him, you know, the words on the screen, and just gets pilloried by other people in the press. But, you know, then.
Yeah, but Dasha was also praised. I mean, I texted Dasha. Lots of us texted her congratulating her and saying she was doing a great job. You focus on what the Twitter criticism, right?
That's interesting.
But her bosses had her back, her newsroom had her back, her friends had her back. I don't count myself as a friend. I just know her, you know. I actually met her. Remember that day Mastriano kicked the press out, wouldn't let the press in, and I went over there and I met her that day. But anyway, I think it's an interesting case because you're right. There was criticism of her for that straightforward reporting. But in my view, that's the usual noise, and there's always going to be that noise, and journalists have to tune out the trolling. They have to tune out the liberal and conservative activists who are always just shouting at them.
And that's too No, but that's
but when they don't, but when they don't tune it out, that's a problem. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if it has a chilling effect. And, you know, I talked to Sharon Waxman in the book, who owns The Wrap, and she says that she has seen her own reporters get pushback and has made them not want to cover stories or cover stories in a certain way because of the reaction that they get on Twitter. And right. You know, it was a pretty big admission. And I think that, but that I don't doubt that that happens. And look, I'm someone who like loves Twitter and I'm on Twitter all the time. And I hate that about myself. But I do feel like I have some self-awareness where I don't necessarily, I know it's fake. Like, you know, if I get 500 right. retweets and people telling right. me great job, I know it's fake. Right. And if I get 50 people telling right. me how horrible I am, I don't take it personally. But it's hard to do. It's a hard thing, I think.
And you have to learn that. You have to learn that ability. It's yeah. harder for younger journalists growing up to have the thicker skin, I think.
Right, right. And yeah. I do wonder about the Twitter incentive structure also. You know, the idea right. that now journalists can become their own brands. And they have. I mean, they speak freely in some cases, like Taylor Lorenz and others, about brand. What does that mean? What does that do to the journalism itself? And does that undermine the journalism that they put out there that may be good journalism, but then they get on a platform where they're trying to build their brand and saying things that are not part of the story. And now all of a sudden we get this peek behind the curtain that we couldn't see before.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I, in some ways that, in my view, like I trust journalists more when I know more about them, but I understand that that also sows distrust and it makes it easier to come up with a reason not to trust someone when right. you can pluck a tweet or a past Instagram out of the digital air.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's right. It leaves this paper trail. You know, I describe it as like, it's like a diary entry that for the world to see. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be about the stories that they're covering. It could be just be about anything. And then all of a sudden there's like, it's ammunition for the people that are trying to discredit them. But in a lot of ways it is this, it's the true thoughts of the journalist. And it's journalism is not a job like any other occupation. You know, the way that a person is sort of positioned, and in I would say in the olden days, like a couple decades ago when social media didn't exist, we barely even knew most journalists' names. You know, now everyone is just so online that it does really change things. And I do think it's different than, say, you know, other occupations where we just don't know as much about that person. Now that we right. know, it makes it's in some cases it can have a detrimental effect.
I think what it's caused is, and tell me if you think I'm right or wrong, it's caused, we're in a situation now where everybody trusts some media, but everybody yeah. distrusts some other media. So everybody has a boogeyman that they think is the enemy in the media, and everybody has, you know, sources that they trust and believe in. And at the end of the day, when there's a tornado warning near you, you actually do trust your local broadcaster. You do trust your meteorologist. So there is some trust there. But you know, then the local station also misquotes your neighbor, or you know, or just totally ignores the biggest story in your town, and then you lose a little bit of the trust, and a lot of those aspects are really, really hard to solve.
Yeah,
I think because they're like it's like the day to day, inch by inch nature of media. You know, you gain an inch, but then you lose an inch.
And it's also, I think, just the nature of the evolution of the press, where we are with just, you know, it is a fact. You know, we've got social media. We've got now the rise of independent media, like with Substack, where individuals can build brands. And the whole conceit is trust me, you know, trust me right. personally. You don't right. even have to go to a gatekeeper. And this happens on both sides. So yeah, I do think it's a real problem. But
that's a good thing, right? Isn't it good to have that? Isn't it good to have, I mean, you've said it earlier, that you want both independent and institutional press. I think they make each other stronger.
I think when done right, they can, and I think they should. You know, so often though, I think that there are, I mean, there's problems with both. I think that there are real drawbacks to independent media that doesn't have the backing of editorial teams or legal teams. You know, you lose something there. And at the same time, I think that the corporate media is seeing their power go a little bit away and go towards more independent outlets, like, you know, like Joe Rogan.
More than a little bit. I think yeah. more than a little bit of power has been lost. You're being nice.
Yeah, no, I do. You, I mean, do you think that there are, I mean, obviously you're at CNN, like the threat of losing, you know, power to upstarts like that, Does that change the thought process of a place like a CNN or New York Times, you think?
Well, I think CNN is a lot of things to a lot of people, right? And to some people at Fox, it's just a, you know, it's a target of mockery. So there's that. There's like the use CNN as a whatever. But CNN's a lot of things, a lot of people. It is a news gathering muscle for many people. It is a companion, a form of companionship. People leave it on all day and like to see the anchors. It is a forum for debate and discussion and analysis, right? If you watch some of the more talking head type shows. So it's all these different things to different people. And what I care about most is the news muscle. Let's just make sure that the news muscle stays strong. It doesn't really matter if I'm there or not there, or some other guy like me is there, but let's make sure the news muscle is strong. When it comes to, you know, independent media, it should be a motivator to the CNNs of the world. And I think it is. I remember, I don't know, this has been out there before, and maybe I shouldn't say it. I think there was a, yeah, there was it. Talk of, there was talk about Barry Weiss, maybe doing a pilot for CNN Plus. And I think she ended up not doing the pilot, and clearly she didn't end up with a show on it. And thank goodness, because CNN Plus was then blown up after only a month. Rest in peace, CNN Plus. But you know, I thought that was a really interesting idea. Whoever thought to try to bring her in for a pilot, that's exactly what the CNNs of the world should be doing, right? Looking for new talent, looking for new voices. When I was doing Reliable on Sunday mornings, I always wanted to book people that I had not seen on TV anywhere else during the week. And sometimes I failed with that and I booked predictable people. But my goal often was, let's bring on new voices. So I think, you know, there's an interplay there that can be mutually beneficial and should be mutually beneficial. And the right approach for the CNNs and the ABCs and the is not to fear or, try to somehow stop. It's impossible to stop the rise of independent media. It's to look for talent and voices and benefit like that.
Yeah, well, why not, right? I mean, there's so many hours in the day on CNN, and then you talk about a streaming platform plus digital. You got podcast opportunities. Why not bring on people like Barry Weiss and let her still do her independent thing as well, but be part of a larger umbrella that brings in a slightly new audience, and it could be mutually beneficial. But at least from some of the reporting, that's kind of where I think Chris Licht's head is at with CNN, at least in some capacity. How do you expand it out to a broader audience? Not, you know, you're not bringing in, you know, Tucker Carlson, but you're bringing in a wider audience through countercultural voices rather than necessarily ideologically different.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm in wait and see mode like everybody else, you know, wondering what primetime is actually going to become. And it's hard, you know, it's hard. If it was easy, they would have already had an answer this time last year, last February, when there was the management change at CNN. This is clearly a challenge. But, you know, as much attention as prime gets or morning gets, I both when I was in CNN and now on the outside, I really believe CNN is the way to measure CNN, the way to measure its impact and its power or its popularity is in the 24-hour cycle, you know, the cumulative audience, the cumulative reporting, you know, not hour by hour, because, you know, ratings go up, ratings go down. The reason CNN has such a unique role that you referenced earlier in the media universe is because it's, you know, it's still that default, thankfully. It's that place people go when there's news, and that's the most important factor.
I gotta say, that's one of my pet little concerns here. The thing that bugs me is that people compare like YouTube numbers to cable news ratings, and they don't understand, talking about an average person watching for a single minute, the cume, as Brian's talking about, cumulative numbers, how many people watch, like say over the course of a month. We're talking about tens of million on CNN, also on Fox News, and it's a much, much larger number of people.
Much larger number. I mean, Fox is such a juggernaut, and especially when you think about it, if you have more than a million people watching every minute of every day, start to do the multiplication, and you get into billions and billions of minutes so quickly. Now, that said, Steve, the audience is aging. I mean, I know there's new 55-year-olds born every day, and someday I'll be one of them, but the audience is aging. It's hard to imagine that our kids are going to be cable news junkies someday. They are definitely going to consume it in a different form. Right. And I think about, you know, in relation to Uncovered, there's the opportunity for change and restoration of trust and growth. The opportunity, I think a lot of it is going to be in a new form factor in whatever replaces and succeeds the phone. Like, it's going to be in You know, maybe whatever the new atomic unit of news is, we can build in ways to make it more trustworthy and help people. I don't know. Now I'm getting all wonky, but this is the stuff I think about when I'm like enjoying unemployment, you know?
well, we are at like at times. So let me ask you, like, is that what you're doing? Atomic units of news? Like, what's your mindset on what's next?
I hadn't used that phrase before, so maybe I shouldn't. Maybe it's somebody else's and I don't even know. I mean, what I'm doing is I'm like loving being a stay-at-home dad and trying to figure out what to do with my big barn. I want to figure out if I should get chickens or goats or anybody listening, if you have advice for me about what to do, what animals to get, let me know.
You're on a farm now, yeah.
Yeah, I'm on a farm. I actually moved literally the same day I left CNN. It was the craziest timing in the world. Like, I was in the moving truck when the news broke. But it was great because I was already moving anyway. We tried to figure out kindergarten for my daughter. And it's been a great 6 months. But every so often, I do want to write a story here and there. So I've started writing here and there for The Atlantic and Fortune and other places. You know, I have a bigger idea, but I can't reveal it quite yet because this is about you today. This is about you. How has book launch week gone so far? I'm turning it back around. Has book launch week fast. Felt so far?
I have one more question for you, but last one. All right, I've been enjoying it. I think it's been I would say that the writing process, writing the book was more straightforward. It was not as stressful as people said it might be. The couple months and then a couple weeks leading up to the book coming out has been much, much more stressful than I expected it to be. But I think there's been some good things this week. I'm trying to keep the idea that I think that luck is playing a big factor in ultimately in how the book does. And I will say, you know, as I sit here going on, you know, cable news green rooms and podcasts and tweeting nonstop about the book and getting the affirmation from Twitter and I'm literally taking the Acela tomorrow from New York to DC. I feel there's a little bit of fraudulence to the whole thing, but I'm trying to be, you know, self-aware about it at least. But no, it's been an interesting.
There's not
experience.
Fraudulence because you got to understand the media insider thing in order to dissect it. I mean,
I know
the way I always describe it, and I know you probably think I failed at this. I feel like I always tried to sit on the edge of the fence with one foot in and one foot out. And I feel like that's what you do. I mean, I think you live in a better place to do it in Texas, but you know, one foot on the inside, one foot on the outside, straddling the fence. Because then when we can explain how it works on the inside to everybody, that's at least the way I like to think about it.
Were you free to do that? You think? I mean, that was,
I feel like I always was. I know people think I'm some, you know, I don't even want the words to come out of my mouth, all the trolling that I've gotten. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, I feel like I had an incredible amount of autonomy at CNN. Like, I don't know if I could ever have, like I wouldn't want to go and do a TV show again unless I had the same degree of autonomy, you know? And so if you didn't like my guest or you didn't like my segment, you know, it was my fault, right? It wasn't anybody else's. And I know that oftentimes in TV, it's not like that. Yeah. I think Tucker Carlson has great autonomy, for better or worse. Rachel Maddow, you know, there are certain figures who it is their show and it is, you know, it is a custom handcrafted artifact. But a lot of times it's not. So for me, writing my own banners, you know, going too long with blocks and not worrying about the commercials, I had so much freedom, and that was really valuable, and I didn't know how rare it was until after I left, to be honest.
Yeah, well, and I mean,
but you just turned it around back on me again.
All right, I'll end it by saying that I think that, you know, I would say people can argue about whether that it always came across on air, but I do think that just from our conversations offline. You know, I know I've certainly been critical of you in Fourth Watch over the years, and I do think that you're someone who is much more introspective than many other people that I would be critical of in the press.
Well, it's hard to be introspective. It's hard to be introspective sometimes when, you know, the president of the United States is waging war against the news media. And I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying, like,
and now we're opening a can of worms.
I know. I shouldn't have done this at the end of the... It's like, hey, here, Brian, here, you have 40 minutes on TV. How do you want to spend those minutes? And it's like, okay, well, I personally think that the war is the most important story, not the peace. But like, I know that's the fight. And you know what's crazy?
He wants it.
We're going to be, and that's the thing, right? We're going to be fighting about this for the rest of our lives. Don't you think? Like the Trump years, like, is this country ever going to get over the Trump years? I don't think so.
Well, here he goes again. So we'll see. We'll see if it continues now.
Uncovered 2 coming in 2029.
That's there you go. Brian, we'll leave it there. I appreciate you doing this, really. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Great talking with you.
All right. That was fun. Thank you to Brian Stelter. And really, I texted Brian after this was done, and I said, I hope that this can be a model for discourse in our culture, in our media. I think we need it. I think we need more conversations between people that don't always agree, but can disagree respectfully and can have that dialogue out in the open, not just behind the scenes, not just through direct message or through text messages or through conversations, but can do so for other people to see and hopefully to get something out of. So I really do appreciate that. I think that was fun, and I hope you did as well. I wanted to tell you that Fourth Watch content can be found at fourthwatch.media. Fourth Watch has gone independent in 2023, is now on Substack. You can become a paying subscriber on Substack, get a whole bunch of extra content, original deep dive columns called Rabbit Hole, as well as full podcast episodes. This one, you get the full one because it's sort of a special episode, but normally you get some extra content for the podcasts. There is a $5 a month or $50 a year for the paid subscription, fourthwatch.media. But again, this podcast is specifically about the new book. Go find that at readuncovered.com, readuncovered.com. I hope you check it out. You can email me at lots of different places, including the very last words of the book, which is a new email address for people that read the book. And we can talk about it because I'm very curious to hear what you have to say. So, Fourth Watch, not just a podcast, also a newsletter. Subscribe for free at fourthwatch.media. Join me. Let's build a better media together. If you like the music in this show as I do, check out the artist who created it, Super Duper. That's Super Duper Music on Instagram. Song is Far From Falling. Download it wherever you get your music. And you can download, follow, like, rate, review this show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, including on Substack. Back soon. Stay safe. Talk to you then.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.